This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. Broadcasting live on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, as well as in the evenings on WCPT 820, Chicago's Progressive Talk. It is the Matt McNeil Show for your Tuesday. Good to have you with us today. Matt and Brett, and we got Patrick Cooligan from the Minnesota Reformer joining us a little bit later on today to talk about some of the issues that's coming up in the 4 o'clock hour. I've got to just take a moment. Brett is producing for us today. Brett, how much have you paid attention to what's going on in New York right now at the Trump trial?
Oh, I've been paying attention, yeah. Not heavily, but I'm still following the fact that he seemed to be a little more awake today compared to other days.
Oh, he did fall asleep, though, at one point.
Oh, he did? I heard he was real awake when Stormy Daniels was up there today.
He was to a point, and then he fell asleep when they came back from lunch. We need to take a moment to understand the momentous level of history that's happening right now. It's one thing to have after a president has passed away or after the fact allegations. This is the first time in history. I mean, we've had multiple presidents who have had affairs. I mean, Kennedy, who comes to Harding, had a lot. I think Grover Cleveland had some. Taft was a womanizer. I know. But
you said Taft was?
Taft apparently was. Well, you got to remember back then, being a big boy like that was considered to be, ooh la la, he's got tons of money. He's living the posh life. And that was the mentality about the whole thing. But we've never had anything like this ever happen in this country, where in a courtroom, someone is describing in incredible detail the fact that clearly she and Donald Trump, a former president and the current nominee to be the president of the United States for the Republican Party. This is one of those moments. I mean, this whole, I think really from 2016 to hopefully when we vote him out again, when Biden wins a second term, I think that this whole stretch is going to be kind of its own section of any kind of history book in this country. But it does just show you how far the Republican Party has fallen with Trump. And it's interesting. I've talked on and off here the last few weeks about what Trump actually accomplished. When he won, he pulled together a voting bloc no one in their right mind would have ever tried to pull together, and it worked for him. No one else will be able to hold the MAGA group together. This is a Trump one and done. Once Trump is gone, whether that's he retires or, God forbid, he passes away. I'm not exactly some kind of person that cheers on death. So, God forbid he passes away or he decides I'm just going to retire and I'm done with this. No one else in that party will be able to coalesce the MAGA faithful like he did. Because it was an insane coagulation in the first place. I mean, the 20-time losers. He brought all the 20-time losers together. And he looked at them and said, "You're not the loser, you're the winner." And they love him for it. They love him for it. And, I already know it's, he didn't sleep with her, but she was lucky he did sleep with her, but he paid her off because he felt sorry for her. But this is a guy that never pays off anybody, even people that he owes money to. The amount of, I was telling someone, I remember when we had 9/11 conspiracy theorists, and the 9/11 conspiracy theorists were making, statements. And it was, I said, okay, you're telling me somewhere around 1,000 to 2,000 people, because that's what you would have needed. You would have needed 1,000 to 2,000 people on board with this conspiracy theory that all of them have kept quiet. Please, Nope, that's just not possible. It's just, you know, we have a tendency, and in this country, we have a tendency to look for conspiracy theories to basically explain things which are traumatic and hard for us to accept. 9/11 conspiracy theories are, they're like a Matlock episode compared to the insanity of the Trump fans' conspiracy theories. That every single judge, that every single lawyer, that every single witness, the whole pandemic thing, remember that? That was all a big conspiracy theory. That every scientist on the planet was lying. That every medical professional, when you went sick to a doctor and the doctor said you have COVID, they were part of the conspiracy. That every nurse was involved. Millions and millions and millions of people have to be involved in their conspiracy to make it even mildly feasible. And yet they still, at no point does it ever cross their mind to step back and say, wow, I sound like a freaking loon ball, don't I? That clearly didn't happen. I guess maybe he might be guilty. Nope, not at all. It is a blind loyalty because, once again, it is for Trump fans, it is terrifying for them to look in the mirror and say, I'm screwing up my life and I need to fix it. They just can't do that. And so Trump saying, you're not the loser, you're the winner. I love you because I don't ever have to acknowledge the fact that I'm a failure in most of my life. It is what it is, man. It is what it is. And if I can say, I am stunned that people still like him and still want to vote for him. Not just because of the fact that they're so agilent towards Trump, but because you see the other side. And once again, last night, terrible storms tearing through Oklahoma, the Midwest plains, just got off. I was watching that one cell down in Oklahoma. Holy God, it just didn't even move. It did not even move for like an hour and a half. Just tormenting those people. And yesterday morning, and people don't like me bringing this up, but it is just a truth, a fact of life. Yesterday morning, there were a lot of people who were screaming, let's go, Brandon! Let's go, Brandon! Laughing at the idea of Kristi Noem saying she wanted to shoot Joe Biden's dog. And thinking that was rip-roaringly funny. And today, they're like, I hope Joe Biden helps us. And he will. And he will. And you know why? Because he's better than you. He doesn't look at the vote tallies before he goes down and sends aid. He doesn't look at whether or not it's a group of loyal Democrats before he decides to roll up his sleeves and send in the crew to help. I can't understand how you guys can look through all this stuff and see a man in Joe Biden who's trying to help you and look at the other side. And I know why. Because, once again, you love the fact that you think that he's going to go after your perceived enemies. That people like me are, you know, as long as he goes and gets him and he kicks him out of his house and he gives us all his stuff. And yeah, get him, because that's the only thing that matters to you. I can't help you guys with that. I just can't. But, you know, here we are today, and I am going to read through some of this because I'm going to read through this and realize we're talking about a former president who's sitting in the courtroom with her, Stormy Daniels. And once again, this is the Republican nominee for president of the United States. I'm basically just going to go through the Stormy Daniels stuff for the most part. I'll give an update here. They're cross-examining her now, but Stormy Daniels started by talking about the meeting Trump for dinner. She says when he first emerged from his hotel suite, he was wearing a silk or satin pajamas, which Daniels compared to those often sported by Hugh Hefner. Ugh. She asked him to change, and he returned in more standard dress clothes. So did he think that he was going to go to dinner wearing PJs? Yikes. As Daniels is talking about entering Trump's hotel suite, Trump whispers to his lawyer, he can't stand feeling or appearing weak or powerless, but that's exactly what he is here. And Daniels is describing in extensive detail an encounter he continued to maintain did not happen. Daniels is describing Trump's suite at Lake Tahoe in a minute detail, every aspect down to the color of the tile. She seems to have a photographic memory. Other presidents have had their secret affairs whispered about over the years, but it's surreal to have Stormy Daniels describing an encounter with Trump this way, live in a witness stand. Trump is well known for as a germaphobe. Stormy Daniels has previously said they had sex without a condom. This section of testimony, which Daniels says she told Trump how frequently she was tested for STDs, could help bolster her credibility of their story. Stormy Daniels says that during her dinner with Trump, she asked about his wife. He told her, Daniels says, he told her not to worry because the two didn't even sleep in the same room. Trump and Melania were married in 2005, the year before this encounter. Oh, that's amore. Oh, that's love, isn't it? I don't blame Melania, by the way. I don't. You see him in the silk PJs?
Not even a year.
Not even a year, man.
I'm done, yeah.
Trump shakes his head slightly, gives a sour look as Daniel says he told her he didn't sleep in the same room as his wife. Stormy Daniels says she asked Trump during the dinner, are you always this rude? Are you always this arrogant and pompous? Well, yes, he is, actually. You know, that's kind of, you know, we now that know that. Like you don't even know how to have a conversation. No, that's also Trump. Petulant man-child. Trump clearly mouths an expletive as Stormy Daniels recalls playfully spanking him with the rolled-up magazine and saying he was much more polite afterwards. Yeah. Stormy Daniels says that Trump told her she reminded him of his daughter. Yee. So I want to make sure we understand this. This is Trump telling a porn star that he's having a sex relationship with, that the porn star reminds him of his daughter. She's smart and blonde and beautiful, and people underestimate her as well, Daniel said. Trump remarked. Yikes.
Far from the first time he's made creepy remarks about his daughter.
God. Stormy Daniels said she came out of the bedroom and found that Trump was in the bedroom waiting for her in his boxer shorts and a T-shirt. She'd been planning to go. He was seated in the bed between her and the exit. What did I misread to get here? She describes thinking. She said she tried to leave and he blocked the path, but not in a threatening manner. Trump is staring right ahead glumly as Stormy Daniels describes him. Well, I'm going to imagine Stormy Daniels was staring ahead glumly too when basically she walked in the room and saw you in boxers and a T-shirt. Sitting on the side of the bed. Eric is there, by the way. Eric is sitting there listening to all this directly behind his dad in court, staring straight ahead as Stormy Daniels describes the sexual encounter and the aftermath in excruciating detail. Yikes. I'll tell you what. I'll get an update on this. I'll continue with what was talked about today. Oh, my God. Gag reflex is activated. It's the Matt McNeil Show. It's the Matt McNeil Show here on your Tuesday, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Where was I in the Stormy Daniels testimony about Trump and his sex life? Oh, that's right. Dear Lord. Oh, God. I'd rather go lick South Michigan Avenue, man. Oh, anyway, let's get into the more excruciating detail here. Susan Hoffinger, the prosecutor, is now asking Stormy Daniels about having sex with Trump, which Trump denies. Did you at some point end up in the bed having sex with him? Hoffinger asked. Daniels says, yes. Did she do air quotes when she said yes, implying that sex, you know, hey, I love Mary O'Connor, like the next guy, but, you know, sorry. When she describes the position they were in, the defense objects. The objection is sustained. Stormy Daniels continues. Thank God. I don't need it.
One of the few times we'll agree with the defense.
It's the newest version. It's the Trump version of the Kama Sutra. Alrighty. Hope you guys like mushrooms. Sorry. Sorry. Yikes. Ow. It hurts. Sorry, people. It's burned into my freaking brain. It's going to be burned into all yours, too. So just buckle on up, all right? Stormy Daniels continues to walk the prosecution through the counter. She says, once again, Trump did not wear a condom. Did you say anything about that? The prosecutor said, no. Daniels replies, asking, why not? I didn't say anything at all. Seems like the act dead around the bear thing seems to like be the best way to get around this at this point. She did, or, you know, throw a bottle of ketchup, you know, and then run. She describes it as brief and repeats that she did not say no to any point. I didn't say anything at all, she says again. Daniels is testifying about a few details that corroborate her story, including who she talked about in the initial counter, as well as further discussions with Trump, who called her Honey Bunch. Oh, God. Oh. Will he call Tom Emmer Honey Bunch when he comes into town for the Minnesota Republican Party dinner here a week from Friday? Hello, Honey Bunch.
Established Emmer will call him anything just to get his support.
Tom and all the Republicans in Minnesota, let me just repeat, just don't say anything. Just lie there, pretend you're dead. It's a bear attack, okay? You're good luck with that, because we all know none of you are going to have the guts to say, oh, no. Yeah, I'm going to give you – this is more of a preview of what the Lincoln-Reagan dinner is going to be like for you guys in Minnesota when Trump comes into town a week from Friday. Trump has claimed he had nothing to do with Stormy Daniels, just as he has nothing to do with any of the women who have made claims against him. But the cumulative testimony extracted from this line of questioning is that Stormy Daniels met with Trump on multiple occasions with dozens of witnesses. Daniels also describes multiple phone calls with Trump, some of which had witnesses, because Daniels says she put Trump on the speakerphone for sport while her friends were present. The jury has also been shown phone contact logs from Daniels' phone and from Trump's assistant's phone. The jurors, who've also listened closely to past witnesses and looked back and forth between witnesses and prosecution as they've asked questions, have appeared to be less focused on Daniels during this testimony. Some are, I don't imagine, man, that court breakfast is not sitting well, I got to imagine, at the end of this. Some are looking down. Some are looking away. It describes, never mind, sorry. Again, impossible to know what it means, but it's something different. Oh, I think we know what it means. You just gotta get that gag reflex going, man. Daniels just said she was not paid on time and that in 2016 she wasn't sure why. He just kept making excuses, she said. And by the way, I want to make sure I point out one thing here, and I mentioned this briefly earlier. Donald Trump doesn't pay his contractors. Donald Trump, he's building a building. They start building the building. He goes, I'm not going to pay you unless you take 1/10 of the amount I was going to pay you, and that's the only money you're going to get, or else I'll take you to court, and basically you'll burn up that much money just in court chaos, because I'll do it. And so he doesn't pay people who are building his buildings. If that's who this cat is, why in the hell would he even pay her if he wasn't trying to shut her up? And by the way, and someone made this point too, that as you listen to this trial, reminder, there are people that were, the whole point was to cover this up so that he would get elected. And because he was elected, because they successfully did cover this up, they basically, now you have women who are being sued, you know, because, you know, heaven forbid, they're choosing their own health care. That is a direct line. That the people that were involved in this cover-up are directly to blame for the hellscape of that Supreme Court's rulings. Absolutely. Daniel said she was not paid on time. In that 2016, she wasn't sure why. He just kept making excuses. At first, she clarified that he in question was Michael Cohen, who paid the hush money. But then she changed her answer and testified that it was Trump who delayed the payment. More specifically, Trump speaking to Cohen, who was speaking to her, that lawyer, then Keith Davidson. That was an interesting moment, almost as if Daniels was trying to make the prosecutor's case for them. Stormy Daniels is laying out the specifics of the hush money deal, a really important part of the testimony after a lot of details that were difficult to follow as she skipped through the meetings and dates and the years of the prosecution guided towards her towards 2016. She said that if she were to violate the agreement, it would cost her $1 million every time she did so. The judge has declined to declare a mistrial. That was something when they came back from lunch, immediately they wanted to declare a mistrial because they said that the Stormy Daniels stuff was too, you know, embarrassing. While the judge acknowledged that some of the evidence that came in was more than he would like to have liked, better left unsaid, is how he put it several times. It makes a much he takes as much issue with the defense as with the prosecution. This becomes a major relief for prosecutors, and I can imagine that they might wish the jury was in the room right now. Justice Merchant reminds the defense that the remedy is on cross examination, meaning that the defense will be able to make its own case as it questions Stormy Daniels. The judge earlier seemed to side with the defense. It's not a great start for Trump's team in the afternoon, though. Stormy Daniels said that, so this we're coming back after the lunch break. Daniels says that once her story became public, her life exploded into chaos. Suddenly, I was in front of Fourmont everywhere. She said that the story blew her cover in an extent, making her more public than she'd been in before. She starts to go on, but the judge cuts her off, and the testimony moves along again. Daniels has previously talked about the chaos that ensued after the allegations about Trump were made public. She was told reporters she was inundated by threats and by Trump supporters, many of them who are lurid and graphic. She said that she feared for her family's safety. In reality, it's like experiencing a different witness than we did this morning. Stormy Daniels has testified about her defamation claim against Trump. The former president appeared to be, while he did this, appeared to be asleep. So he comes back from lunch, apparently had a heavy lunch, and he got drowsy and he's sleepy. Once again, the guy that complains the other guy is sleepy. Yeah. Some of the jurors, while Trump says, are taking detailed notes on Daniels' testimony. It comes back now with the cross-examination. I'm going to bring this up. And once again, it's a lot this hour talking about this. But once again, we cannot skip past this. This is a huge historical moment, actually, in this country. It is really weird, but it's true. It's the Matt McNeil Show.
I'll show you the ropes, kid. Show you the...
Broadcasting in the evenings on WCPT 820 Chicago's Progressive Talk and in the afternoons on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. So after the lunch break, when Trump decided to take a nap after the end of the prosecution talking to Stormy Daniels, the defense team stood up, Aaron. Obviously, this is goes exactly where you think it is. It basically the defense lawyers screaming at Stormy Daniels and, you know, they're clearly trying to attack her. The problem that multiple reporters are saying is that the Trump team is only so much focused on trying to hurt her credibility, not counterpointing any of the claims, which are the point of the case itself, which is, you know, which, by the way, once again, if there's anything that just tells me that this is Trump, this is 100% being guided by Trump, it's that. He doesn't care really about the case. He just wants to see her get attacked. And whereas, you know, I think it gets some level of, you know, there comes a point where the jury is going to go back and look at all this testimony and say, well, most of this doesn't really apply because, you know, the defense attorney, Susan Nicheles, she basically didn't point out. Nicheles is continuing to push Stormy Daniels, who previously tweeted that she would not pay Trump a penny even after a federal court ordered her to cover his legal fees as a result of a failed defamation suit. The lawyer for Daniels had said that the money does not, in fact, be owed to him. I'm curious on how to know the jurors whose finances are likely closer to Daniels than Trump's will feel about Nichelle's focus on money. Once again, this is a cross-examination that doesn't offer an alternative narrative about the heart of the case. This time, the focus is on Daniels' refusal to pay Trump's legal fees aimed at damaging her credibility. There was then a back and forth between Nichelle's and Stormy Daniels to acknowledge that she had mocked Trump's looks on Twitter, and then Daniels replies, because he made fun of me first. Nichelle says then you both that one of them started it, but you both continued it. It's hard to know what the effect of this line of question will have on the jury. Trump's lawyer, Nichelle, has successfully established that Stormy Daniels is refusing a court order to pay legal fees to Trump, which she's ordered to do 6 years ago. But the jury knows that Trump is vastly wealthier than Daniels, so that's not exactly a hurt. They then went out and kind of went after her to try to make her look like a liar. Stormy Daniels just fended off an implication that that Nichelle was seeking to make, which was that Daniels hopes that Trump will be convicted if he doesn't have to pay his legal fees. I hope I don't have to pay him no matter what happens. Trump's lawyer is moving on to say that the telling of, which was a good answer because that's the lawyer moved on there. But, you know, they accuse her of making a lot of money off of telling the story about having sex with Trump. Then basically she made the point, well, it's also cost me a lot of money. They brought in some of the book excerpts from Stormy Daniels' book. Here, the courthouse overflow room is decidedly less tense. Members of the public are laughing along with Daniels' responses, kind of in conjunction with her. Nichelle is walking Daniels through specifics of her book and gets to say that one thing that she's described in the book is incorrect. Daniels sticks to other parts of her story. One coming moment was Nichelle is pushing Daniels about the threat she claimed she encountered, challenging her to not tell about her baby's father, about the alleged threat, and implied it was made up. So basically, this is the threat. She was in a parking lot in Vegas, I believe it was, and she was approached by someone and was threatened, and they're trying to make it seem like, once again, this has nothing to do with the Trump case, but they're just basically trying to focus a lot on that. Then she basically tries to paint it as there is a nefarious relationship with Cohen, which did not exist. And once again, bringing it, this is Maggie Haberman. During Stormy Daniels' cross-examination so far, Trump's lawyer has hardly asked her about the matter of the heart of the case, whether there was a conspiracy to cover up a hush money payment made to a porn star, Daniels before the election, and whether business records were falsified in the process. Trump's lawyer has insisted, instead focused on whether Daniels embellished her story about having someone threaten her in Las Vegas by someone supposedly connected to Trump. The lawyer, Nichelle, is seeking to attack Daniels over credibility, but Daniels told a very detailed story early in the morning about what she says with her sexual encounter with Trump, and it's not clear how the jurors are processing what they're hearing right now. It definitely was very different than the very dry testimony the day earlier. They're probably going to be cross-examining of Stormy Daniels tomorrow as well. I think that was by design. I think they definitely want to huddle and find some way they can attack Stormy Daniels tomorrow. So they're already saying that this is not going to be done today. They were saying they're going to go to about 4:30 Eastern, so that would be about 8 minutes ago. I got an update here. I'll get to that here in a second. Trump's lawyer is spending the final minutes of today's testimony battling with Stormy Daniels. Nichelle accuses Daniels directly of seeking to extort Trump through the hush money deal. False, Daniels said. That's what you did, right? Nichelle then repeats. False, Daniels says, almost yelling in the courtroom. The defense has been building this climactic moment since last week, but once again, they're not really addressing the charges that have been made here. Stormy Daniels has said several times both that she didn't want money for her account of having had sex with Trump, and she wanted to get the story out. She just said it again, but she did strike a deal accepting money to stay silent, which is once again from Trump. Okay, once again, you have... It's clear she and Trump were together. It's clear at this point. Her description of the hotel room, of the things in the hotel room, at the very least, all Trump could say at this point was, yeah, I had a porn star in the room, but I let her go. And reminder, this was right after the Access Hollywood tape, where he's talking about, I can rape. He was basically bragging, I could rape any woman I wanted to because if you've got money, they'll let you do it. And so here he is with this story backing up his own claim on Access Hollywood, and he's acting as if, this is something. Yeah, he's a slime ball. He is an absolute slime ball. His wife is at home. He's married to a woman who, and Melania Trump, I don't think she's necessarily the brightest ball, but at the same time, I don't think she deserved this guy. And I think she got stuck with this guy when he started to run for office. But here he is. He's got a wife who's a model herself, just at home with a kid. And he's out there actively trying, to basically have sex with a porn star right away, and for the most part, bad mouthing his wife. A year after, we don't even sleep in the same room with each other, dude. That's on you, man. Okay, I can already tell you. Yeah, I'm Team Melania on that one. It is, and yet today, he's still the greatest hero ever. And I mean, how long will it take for people to say he never slept with her, but if it did, it was the greatest night of her life. But she should disparage him, and she should have, she got money, but he never paid her in the first place. I mean, it just, you can see them twisting in the wind because, once again, his supporters are desperate to keep this fake narrative of they're not a loser alive. And the only way that stays there is if Trump is there. So they're going to, they've decided this is the ship they're going to sail on. And it does bring up a interesting side note, because there is, I don't know, and forgive me, I'm not sure of how the county's races necessarily have gone in Illinois. I can tell you, I've paid a little attention to what's going on the Republican side in Minnesota. And we have a few counties here, which, for the lack of a better way to say it, have imploded. The Republican parties there have imploded. Where it's these MAGA, shut everything down and fire everybody, and I'm still going to have all my services, but nobody else gets any services, sort of stupidity. And traditional Republicans who realize you can't just do that and think things are going to go well. It's like when the idiots talk about, in the state of Minnesota, talked about ceding the 2/3 western part of the state to South Dakota, and when you look at how much money those counties take from the Twin Cities metro area to just pay their bills, bon voyage! Trust me, it will be a surprise when you merge with South Dakota. We'll let it be a surprise. We'll let it be a surprise. But these parties are breaking apart. Michigan's Republican Party has been beset with vicious infighting. Power struggles since Trump's election loss there in 2020. And a report warns the GOP it's possible preview of what's going to face in the other states. Election conspiracy theorist Christina Caramo was removed as the state GOP chair earlier this year after a chaotic reign, but her loyalists are now hostile to the new chairman, Pete Hoekstra. Remember that guy from the House. And bitterness lingered in a recent meeting to help nominate the 2024 presidential candidate. Despite wildly held agreement, it should be Trump. The process was acrimonious, reported Slate. The MAGA activists in the charge are eating each other alive. There are four other people in here that rose their hands to discuss, said former reality TV star Billy Putman, a GOP delegate at the meeting. Discussion is discussion until it's ended. The discussions went on for hours as attendees aired grievances and conspiracy theories about brainwashing operations and Chinese communist plots. And the process was repeatedly halted by arguments about rules for conducting the meeting. GOP veteran Michelle Smith offered a simple theory for the chaos and the dysfunction. The report said the problem seems to be from the type of people Trump has spurred into activism, and that is echoed across the country. Trump's sudden rise and surprising 2016 victory attracted a new cohort of activists who had not previously been politically engaged and not on some level understand that it is possible to lose an election. I've suffered losses before, Smith told me on the morning of the convention. The loss is a loss, but they get off the couch and say, why didn't we win? Caramo, a former community college professor and occasional GOP volunteer, serves as a clear example of that path to politics, which she began actively engaging in during the vote counting process in 2020. Her ally, Angela Hall, who leads the local GOP chapter in the Upper Peninsula, also exemplifies Smith's theory that basically they couldn't possibly lose. So henceforth, there's no point in talking about anything else. Education, transportation, health and human services, agriculture, environment, because the only thing that matters is the conspiracy theories they want true. And it should be noted, we actually have had a template where we played this game out in Arizona with the Cyber Ninjas guys. And all this reminder, they basically shut that thing down and the Cyber Ninjas came in and we're going to prove it all. And they ended up proving that Biden actually got more votes. And, well, and Cyber Ninjas stole all the voter data and took it to Montana. But still, I mean, you guys are idiots. But you see, you were out there screaming about bamboo ballots and all these things, and none of it was true. But what did they say? Did they say, well, I guess we were wrong? No. Well, they didn't do it right. We need to go back and do it again. Because they just, if they don't win, if they're on the wrong side of this, then at some point they have to look in the mirror and realize they're the idiots. And they are so terrified of doing that, that they will scream about things as ludicrous as drinking babies' bloods in the basement of a pizza restaurant because it's the only thing that they've got. Sure, Donald Trump is horrible, but he's not a vampire beast, demon creature, alien trying to harvest our organs to eat at the DNC. He's better than that, so I'd ride with Trump. Gotta watch out for those vampire creatures, man. Oh, it's trouble. You know, that's why I put on Rain-X on my car. I have no idea. What's going on within these Republican parties is this. Once the minute you went out there and you brought in, Sarah Palin, and you brought in, and that was in 2008. And in 2004, they brought in all the lunatic fringe groups because the blue-collar workers had abandoned George W. Bush, and so they brought in the lunatic fringe to win that election. And then you go back to turning to Newt Gingrich after they lost in 1992. You go through all this stuff. You go back to the 1970s when they basically all of a sudden, you know, decided to get in with religious fundamentalists because they said, well, at least they'll be foot soldiers in the, you know, post Roe v. Wade world. And that's where they got. They have gone down this path, and now they seem to be surprised when they get into the room and they say, the earth is flat. The earth is flat, and that's our biggest priority. And you're like, how is this even possible? It's even possible. And by the way, and this has gone across the board. I got one more story on this to share before when we come back. It's the Matt McNeil Show. It is the Matt McNeil Show. The Onion, once again, beating everyone to the punch. Eric and Don Jr. baked data cake with a gavel inside.
You can take over the court now, Dad. You're the winner.
Oh, God. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I kept wondering, as Eric just stared silently ahead, was he like, is that what sex is about? Anyway, no, I just
Dad never took me to Tahoe.
He's your weirdo, man. He is your weirdo. Yeah, but shut up. Shut up. You gleefully got into bed with that orange clown. You own this, man. You own this. Once again, in 2016, he mocked a disabled man, and then the Access Hollywood tape came out, and you guys said, I love him. That's on you. That's on you. You having to basically realize who you came to the dance with. Well, that's, yeah. Hey, I'm not going to help you with that. By the way, I was going back to the conversation about the Republicans and how they've really divided. They've fallen into this MAGA camp and the traditional Republican camp, and whether or not they'll be able to merge those two together. They're not going to, okay? Because you do understand the MAGA side has gone so far to the right, they've embraced Nazis, not those Nazis. And what was it? Trump just got invited by the Libertarian Party to speak at their convention? Am I crazy? Did I see that?
Yeah, I saw that too. That is an odd development.
The Libertarians, back in the 1980s when I was a kid in high school, we would go to the political party thing and they'd have it. the libertarians were so far away from the Republican Party. Now they basically look at the Republican Party as libertarian light. I mean, it's crazy, man. House Oversight Reform Committee held a Tuesday hearing discussing the increase in anti-Semitic attacks on Americans and college campuses. And Representative Scott Perry, the Republican from Pennsylvania, used it as a moment to promote the fringe conspiracy theory, the Great Replacement Theory. According to the excerpt of the transcript posted, the meeting was held behind closed doors when Jamie Raskin, when my colleague from Maryland talked about white replacement theory is real, complained Perry. They added white to stop everyone from talking about it, Perry continued, without elaborating on who he was referring to. But bringing people into the country, I think most people on the right are happy to accept people but are highly legal, are here legally, including me, as my ancestors immigrated legally to become Americans. But what's happening now is we're importing people from the country that we want to be in America, but we have no interest in being Americans, and that's very different. And to disparage the comments is to chill the conversation so we can continue to bring in more people that are un-American. The so-called replacement theory is a conspiracy that claims that white race is under the threat of extinction at the hands of the Jews and other minority groups. The similar conspiracy theory was prevalent in Nazi Germany. And here it is now as not only is it a belief of a Republican, they're actually bringing in Nazi language in their defense in the Congress. I don't know where you go, Republican Party. I don't know where you go, but you know, it's clear you guys are, you know, especially in the post-Trump age, whenever that happens, and I think that's going to be a few months down the road. In the post-Trump age, when he loses in November, you guys are going to be sitting there wondering, I mean, and it's going to be an all-out civil war within your own party on who gets to control it. And it's going to come down to one thing. They're going to say, well, they said Joe Biden won just because he got more votes. And the traditional Republicans are like, no, I didn't. You know, it's just, it's crazy, man. One other thing too, Republicans themselves are not helping their own cause. U.S. Senator Deb Fischer, this is from the Ag Report here. Deb Fischer says the farm bill discussions have stalled in the Senate. Now, Deb Fischer is a Republican. We're on pause right now, and we're paused because my party, the Republicans, we need to have more farm in the farm bill. Okay. What do you think the farm bill is? Because it's about farming. But that's when she gets to the clear here. The Nebraska Republican tells Brownfield, the final version needs to protect farm safety net programs. Oh, really? Oh, whoa. I thought you guys were of the mindset that social safety net programs, including the ones for the ag sector, that they're evil and need to be cut. Oh, that's right. You're for those as long as they go to the people you want them to go to. I see. And by the way, I've seen multiple people speculate that this might be the way they try to do what the MAGA Republicans want, which is to stop Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare for just the people they don't like and then keep it for themselves. And what the implication is going to be is they'll try to roll it into the ag bill so that if you're an ag producer or if you get a farmer or if you just have a rural address, well, your social safety net programs are still in place because we believe in those when it's the ag sector. It's just if you don't have a farm, that if you live in a city, if you have a more urban address, well, we're not going to allow you to have your social safety net programs. That's kind of the way that they've said it there. So that's I don't think you're... The ag bill has to deal with ag issues. I'm not saying Republicans won't try this, but it's going to be a far stretch. And reminder, there also would be a lot of Republicans in suburban areas that would be omitted from this, which they still have to figure that out. But that's, I think that might be the path they tried on, at least. Back to this born-again social safety net Republican. We're going to continue to work with the Democratic colleagues on the committee to make sure we have those kind of investments, the farm safety net programs. Fisher says she's working to get two bills included that would provide an increase of funding for precision agriculture. Once again, she's describing handouts to massive ag corporations as farm aid. But still, funny story. They're all for spending money as long as for people that they agree with. And that's always what the Republicans have been. Hey, Chicago, have a good one. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Minneapolis, St. Paul, hour two up next. Hour number two of the show here on your Tuesday. Good to have you with us today. Matt and Brett here today. Patrick Cooligan from the Minnesota Reformer joining us here in just a little bit. 952-946-6205. So I'm going to guess that because of the nature of this trial. And now I don't know if you remember earlier today when the prosecutor let the defense know, oh, it's Stormy Daniels is going to be testifying today. Initially, Trump had made some post that he quickly deleted because he would have violated the gag order about Stormy Daniels. Since then today, I have had a ton of just random drive-by MAGA heads, you know, making comments on all of them, any of the posts I have on social media, Twitter. I see a little bit of it on Threads. It's growing a little bit more on Threads, but not that much. And I mean, there's a little bit over on Facebook, but not much there either. But you know, it's mostly on Twitter. It's all people like, he's gonna win again. You're just scared. You know, this is all these people who have said Donald Trump is going to be found innocent, who are all of a sudden realizing Donald Trump's not going to be found innocent, and they're basically just trying to scream into the wind at this point. How's the station Twitter feed doing?
We don't have too many trolls right now, but I wouldn't be surprised if they roll in because, as you said, this seems very coordinated that, yeah, a bunch of profile pictures with eggs are just saying, Donald Trump is going to win. Yeah,
you know,
and then no followers or anything. Yeah,
or they have a brand. They have a brand that we brought up yesterday, and I don't know if you caught this, but yesterday when the Republicans, were self gratifying to the idea that Donald Trump was going to come on out and be the keynote speaker for the Lincoln Reagan dinner, which is a week from Friday. It was Patrick who first said on the 17th, who said, isn't that the day that Trump is taking off his trial so he can go to Barron's graduation ceremony? And we looked into it, and initially the one report we found was that the graduation ceremony was supposed to be held at 7 p.m. Eastern. 7 p.m. Eastern. And that's a Friday night. That doesn't surprise me. I mean, that's I don't think that that's too uncommon. You either do it kind of on a weekend, or you do it at a time in the evening on a weeknight so most people can get there, right? There have been some people, I've had one guy, or two guys actually, say they thought that it had now been moved to the morning. Now, would I put it past the private school in Palm Beach, Florida, to move the graduation to accommodate Trump? No, I wouldn't. Would I put it past them to create a special second graduation event just to get Trump in and out? I wouldn't. But to be fair, once again, this is coming from Palm Springs, Florida. That is that's like a 5-hour flight to Minneapolis. I mean, it's on the southern side of Florida. So even if the thing is at like noon, it's going to be tight getting him up here. And he's going to, I'm going to guess that it's going to be interesting to see if he can make it up here in time.
Or the other possibility, he's not going to the graduation at all.
Oh, there's very well. I'll say this: you remember how Trump gets when he gets to where his public image is damaged like this? He has always been a guy when he was in the White House, where when bad news came on out, he'd just go out to a press conference and do the verbal equivalent of dropping his pants and wagging his butt in the media's face, and immediately whatever was going to be talked about, you have to go talk about Trump wagging his butt in everyone's face. That's just the way he did things. He would counterpunch things by being more outrageous at that point. And, we're going to invade Mexico. What? You're going to do what? What? You're going to do what? But he'd say these things just because it got the bad headlines off the top of the page. This is a guy, he doesn't have that ability to do that as much anymore, and he needs to still be relevant, so he can't just drop trow or anything like that. So he has a tendency sometimes of, he kind of hides, he kind of withdraws. And it'll be interesting to see if after this, because once again, this was a big hit to him. Today's testimony was a big hit for him. And it'll be interesting to see if how much socializing he wants to do. And maybe he does want to go to Barron's graduation. Go there, have a private get-together, do something off the screen, cancel out. I could see something like that. He's not going to win Minnesota. I mean, come on. He's not going to win Minnesota. You guys, you're delusional if you think that that's going to happen. But I got to ask this about the Minnesota Republican Party. How much of this money, I mean, you guys usually do this as a fundraiser. I mean, these are usually big fundraisers. People give a lot of money, get a few photos with whoever the celebrity is. Trump doesn't do that. As a matter of fact, he was making the comment about that he was at a photo op. He was at a get together with a photo op, and they weren't paying him enough, which was, by the way, far less than the tables are being paid here. He's going to take most of the money off of this. I got to believe that's just what he's doing lately.
Yeah, exactly. That's typically what he does when we were talking about how he's making these state parties pay him tributes. I mean, yeah. If they're going to have this fundraiser, how much money is going to go to the Minnesota Republican Party? Could they lose money from this fundraiser? That's a possibility.
I wonder how much, if he demands, say, at least half the take, it's going to get close. Now, I'm sure that there will be some wealthy Republicans in town here that will scratch out a check to cover things. But they are, if you're a Republican, I cannot imagine you should be anticipating having any money whatsoever.
Yeah,
for the election.
Yeah, this won't be funding your campaign. Write this off as a loss.
And just, you know, remove any references to Trump off your webpage after this is all done and basically hope no one comes and say, where's your tribute? One last thing here before we get to Cooligan. So, I don't know. You know we have on those ramps. Because someone that just moved here asked me this question. It was like, what's with the carpool lane on the meter ramps? So, well, if you're in a carpool, you can use that lane. And they said, well, I've seen a few people use it. No one was in a carpool. Now, I remember when they opened those lanes, some woman who had bought the sensor that allowed her to take the carpool lane, the pay-to-ride lane on 394, was using those ramps. And she said, I thought that that gave me access to those ramps. And they said, no, that doesn't give you access to those ramps. That is solely for carpools, that you have to wait through the meters. Since I noticed this, like I said, about a month ago, I started paying attention. And I can tell you the one that I see a lot is when I'm driving from here back home, it's the ramp from Crosstown eastbound heading northbound 169. I see, you know, two or three people use it every time I use it. Not a single person is in a carpool. Not a single person is in a carpool. I mean, we built all these things and no one is enforcing these rules on that stuff anymore. It's kind of one of those things where I wonder if they're now just completely useless. Do we just block them off at this point?
One or two. Do the cops even want to enforce that thing when you can make the argument, well, I didn't know. Maybe get away with a warning if you were to get pulled over, which I'm guessing rarely happens.
Well, I mean, they don't pull people over for speeding hardly anymore. Yeah. You know, they don't, you know, and I get it. It's you know, pick your poison. In a perfect world, you have that. But, you know, if you're not going to use them, if you're not going to enforce them, well, then just shut them down. Just shut them down, put up barricades on them, and just say, we're done with this little experiment. I mean, it's. I understand you want to regulate traffic so much to a point why you have the traffic lights there, but if you've got a carpool lane that's only supposed to be for carpools and a bunch of people are using it and going around the lights, then the entire thing is useless. The lights are useless. That's a waste of taxpayer dollars. The extra lane is useless. That's a waste of taxpayer dollars. Why are we doing this anymore at this point? I mean, honor system, well, that's a lot of money to spend just to see if we can test the honor system. Oh, by the way, it doesn't work. People will try to sneak around it and go too fast anyway. It really is remarkable. I mean, there's so few people that even care about, you know, they just go through it and they don't care. Usually going through it really fast. Really fast. So 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Just a thought. I wanted to bring that up too. You and Patrick Cooligan got a chat today again, right?
Yeah, today we're mainly talking about the end of session and some of the bills they're working on at the state legislature. Also talking about the ethics hearing, which is taking place for Nicole Mitchell. Uber and Lyft, at least at the state legislature, legislative leaders say they have an agreement, but Uber and Lyft and Governor Tim Walz weren't part of that, so still a long ways to go with that. And we'll also get Patrick's column talking about the monopoly, or at least emerging monopoly, that is United Health Group. So lots to get to today with Patrick.
Patrick Cooligan from the Minnesota Reformer joining Brett right now, right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. And as usual on Tuesdays, we are joined by the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. That's Patrick Cooligan, as we're going to be talking about some of the latest political stories that they've been working on, as well as some opinion pieces. As today, we'll be talking about the last few weeks of the legislative session, including the ethics hearing against State Senator Nicole Mitchell. We'll also be talking about some bills the legislature is working on, as well as Patrick's column on the recent congressional hearings with United Health Group. So lots to get to today. Patrick, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So let's start things off with the state legislature and something that, of course, I and a lot of other people have been following, and that's what's been happening with Uber and Lyft, because those two companies are threatening to leave the city of Minneapolis after new requirements that the city recently passed. Uber and Lyft have said it would require them to pay too much money to their drivers, so they are threatening to leave the city. But the state legislature has stepped in and may have reached an agreement, although a caveat with the agreement is that neither of the companies, Uber or Lyft, were involved, as well as Governor Tim Walz, but could be a step towards trying to get this impasse resolved. So what exactly, Patrick, is in this agreement that the legislature has made that could potentially at least be a step towards ending the stalemate between the city of Minneapolis and Uber and Lyft?
Yeah, there's a number of hoops that are going to or hurdles that they're going to have to get over to get to a deal that everybody can live with. And I guess this would qualify as one of them, and that is an agreement between the city council, where the majority progressive bloc had really forced the issue to begin with, and then legislators who are really intent on getting a bill that can pass and that Tim Walz will sign. If you remember, he vetoed. It's the only veto of his tenure. He vetoed a bill last year with minimum rates, and he seemed to take seriously the threat that the companies would leave. So they have come down on the per mile price to $1.27 per mile and 49 cents per minute. But as you noted, the problem here is that it was a compromise that did not involve the two companies, and they still are now threatening to leave. And again, they, as you mentioned, they did not have the input of Governor Walz. His folks did put out a statement. They called it a positive step, but we're far from having a deal. A really key player in all this is Senator Omar Fatah. He was the chief author of the bill last year, the bill that got vetoed. He, I think, is seen as close to the Minneapolis City Council's progressive bloc, as well as the activist driver group that has been advocating for the minimum rates, although I should note that there's division amongst drivers about what to do. So in any case, they really needed his sign off. And the reason they need his sign off on anything is because of that one vote majority that the Democrats hold in the Senate, which of course is even more precarious given the legal troubles of Senator Nicole Mitchell, which I would probably be a decent segue into the next issue.
Yeah, and in fact, let's go ahead and talk about Senator Nicole Mitchell, because she is having her ethics hearing today, at least the first day of it. So I'm curious what exactly we can expect from this hearing today, because obviously for Democrats, this poses quite a challenge for them, having only that one seat majority in the state Senate and still bills that they would like to see passed. But they are still trying to hold Nicole Mitchell accountable for what happened with her break-in from a few weeks ago. So what can we expect today from the hearing?
Yeah, I don't expect that they would take any action. That would be pretty unusual, and it would also set a very disturbing precedent if you were to remove a senator, for instance, on the basis of an arrest, because it certainly doesn't show much respect for the legal systems, the words that are the basis of our legal system, that we're innocent until proven guilty. But it's certainly going to be quite a media circus and another a difficult news cycle for Senate Democrats. I think they were probably felt like they had to call this ethics hearing, and they did so quicker than they usually do, than we've seen in the past with ethics hearings. So I think they felt like they had to do it, but it's going to be just kind of another circus-like atmosphere surrounding it. And she said she's not going to resign. And if she did resign, you know, they need to have a 33-33 Senate without a way to replace her, because it takes too long to get the special election. So they're really not in a great spot, because every vote that they take in that 34-33 Senate, Republicans are going to make the claim that it's an illegitimate vote because she doesn't belong there. So it's another tough day for Senate Democrats.
I wonder how this plays into this politically as well, and that's the fact that Donald Trump is scheduled to come to Minnesota on May 17th, and I could very easily picture him making that political fodder, saying, well, look at me, I'm being prosecuted for all of my crimes in New York, and here we have Democrats leaving, letting one of their own stay in office after basically dressing up like a burglar and then going to a house and breaking in. I wonder if that could play a role in this as well, with Trump coming to town on May 17th and just very shortly.
Right. Of course, it works the other way as well. Republicans are up on their high horse about Mitchell and the honor and ethical standards that they supposedly believe so much in, and yet the leader of their party, who is going to be here, is on trial for business for falsifying business records to use money, hush money, for to cover up his affair with a porn star. So it creates an interesting dynamic for both parties, and I'm sure this is why Democrats really want this problem to go away as quickly as possible. And as soon as the session's over, they're going to really lean on Mitchell to resign. I don't know her, and so I don't know what her temperament is, but I just can't imagine that she would want to continue with this, continuing in being in the public eye like this, and can certainly imagine wanting to resign as soon as the session is over. And then, frankly, I think everybody forgets about it really quickly, but that's only in the case if she resigns. If she doesn't, then certainly you can see Republicans using this as a campaign issue through the fall, and it certainly negates a lot of, or at least some of the anti-Trump message that Democrats will certainly want to run on.
And no matter what happens with Nicole Mitchell in the coming weeks, whether she resigns immediately or at least does stay in office for a few more weeks to try to help the DFL get a few more bills passed before the end of the session, I am curious, what is the legislature still working on as we approach the end of the session? What differences do House and Senate leaders still need to iron out? I know I was looking through, it looks like they have a bill where large corporations that make $250 million or more in gross domestic sales would have to publicly disclose their tax returns. We also have this that I know they're working on, basically a state-run tax filing system that would kind of mirror the IRS system, where Minnesotans could then file e-file their state returns for free, which would certainly be a good thing to have. So I'm curious, what are they working on over the past few weeks, or what are they working on here as we try to close up the session, especially amid what's happening with Nicole Mitchell? Any bills you're thinking that might be able to get through in the next few days and weeks?
Well, luckily for Democrats and those of us who are sympathetic to their aims, they did all their major work last year. They passed a big budget, had a lot of important programs, and passed a lot of other important laws. This year, they are wheezing through the finish line, and in part because of the Mitchell issue, but also just being an election year, I think they have a lot of members who are very nervous about November, and they're nervous about taking tough votes. And now this Mitchell situation in the Senate, it just, whenever you have conflict between progressives and moderates, or between the House, which tends to be a little bit more progressive, and the Senate, and you mentioned those tax provisions, a couple of those are not in the Senate bill. It's just going to be very easy for Senate DFL senators to just say, look, it's not the year. We can't have it. We're just, you know, we're barely going to get through here. So luckily, they don't have a super ambitious list of legislative items they're trying to get through. One of them would be a infrastructure bill. They call it around the Capitol a bonding bill. The issue with that is it requires a supermajority, so they need some Republican votes. And so that's usually where Republicans have some leverage, not just on where we spend money on infrastructure projects, but also that can also extend to other policy areas. And so we'll see, you know, Republicans generally have gone along with it, although not always. Because they like to see, they often will get good projects that are needed in their districts. But we'll have to see if Republicans think that if they can make enough noise about this session and the Mitchell situation and actually not do a bonding bill, that's always possible. They do need those Republican votes to get it done. Then there's some supplemental budget items that I'm sure everybody would like to have, but they're not must-do items. The budget year was last year. They passed a two-year budget last year. It was very far-reaching and ambitious, so that's in place. So they're lucky insofar as this incident happened this year, not last year. If it were last year, it would have been a total disaster because they had that long list of ambitious programs and policies there they eventually did pass, and I'm sure if this had happened a year ago, I think a lot of that would have been a doubt. So not a hugely ambitious to-do list, and but whatever they have left on that list, I think it's going to be a challenge to get it done.
And finally, one more story to hit up before we have to wrap things up today, and that has to do with your column that you recently wrote on United Health Group. Title is, Senators Are Right to Scrutinize United Health, Minnesota's Most Powerful Company, because they recently had their CEO give a testimony at Congress last week, and that's because, recently United Health had a major hack of their what's called their Change Health system, which basically disabled a network that handles about $2 trillion in insurance claims annually. And this hack really ended up hurting a lot of small medical providers because they didn't have another way to get their money back during that period. So I'm curious, what may have we missed from last week's testimony of United Health Group CEO Andrew Witty at the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance? It sounds like he was at least really, really sorry about that hack. Helps, though, when you make $25 million a year. So what may have we missed there? What may have Minnesotans missed last week from that testimony?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea for Minnesotans to try to educate themselves about United Health. Because I think even though it's a hometown company over there in Eden Prairie now, they moved from Minnetonka to Eden Prairie, I think people don't really realize how big and powerful and influential they are, and how critics really see them as being far too powerful in such an important industry. And you mentioned the hack of Change Healthcare, and what that did was it disabled those payments from insurers from health insurers to medical providers. In some cases, in many cases, small medical providers who could not go without those payments, they were struggling to meet payroll because of the this malfunction. And I mean, and what's funny about all this is that United Health has this other arm called Optum. It's their health services division. They're going around and buying small practices, which it's like a rather bitterly ironic moment here where these small practices can't get paid. And then Optum is swooping in and offering to buy these practices. So that's one part of the issue here is, and that's why presumably we don't know for sure, but the Justice Department has an antitrust investigation going to determine whether or not the company's is engaged in anti-competitive practices. And interestingly, I believe the chair and some senior executives sold stock right before the public became alerted to the antitrust investigation. So that's certainly of interest. And there's been also plenty of reporting, most recently in a story that we ran from the nonprofit journalism outlet called ProPublica, about the extreme lengths that United Health often goes to deny medical care to its policyholders. You know, I think that's sort of a, you know, I call that like an oldie but a goodie when the insurance company refuses to pay for your health and for your health needs. So it's a big, sprawling, incredibly opaque, complex company. And they were in front of the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance over this the hack of their payment system, which had devastating effects across the medical care. But there's a lot that we ought to be examining about this company, and I would hope that Minnesotans would really tune in.
Yeah, I hope they do as well, because it is easy to forget how powerful this company is, which, by the way, just up the road from where we're located here at the station in Eden Prairie, with the expansion they've been doing over years and years, and they keep growing and growing, at least as you note in the column as well. There has been some action from the Biden administration, at least on taking some antitrust actions against them, but still, yeah, a long ways to go with this, with how large United Health has become over the past few years. Well, we are just about out of time. We've been speaking with the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. That's Patrick Houlihan. Make sure you follow what the Minnesota Reformer does over at minnesotareformer.com again for the latest in Minnesota news and politics. Patrick, as always, thanks for coming on the show today.
It's always a pleasure.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. Thank you, Patrick Houlihan there. By the way, it is confirmed that apparently whether it's the entire graduation for Trump's kid has been moved to 10 a.m. or if they're just doing a special one for Barron at 10 a.m., it does look like 10 a.m. now as they're doing it. Now, mind you, none of that was public until people started pointing out, hey, wait a minute here. Isn't that the day you're supposed to be down at Barron's graduation? So this might be a case where the private school is taking one for Trump and has moved. Because like I said, the initial report was that graduation was supposed to be like 7 p.m. that night. So, you know, either they move. If that was true, either they're moving the entire graduation or they're just having a special one just for Barron and Trump so that they can kind of get done.
He said this school's in Florida, so it wouldn't surprise me if they moved it for him, being a private school too.
Oh, I was looking at their website. That just screams right wing Republican. I mean, it's you know, we're a fine institution. I'm doing it. So I want to get back to this Uber Lyft thing, because Uber and Lyft keep saying we're committed to making sure our drivers make a livable wage. Well, the only way you're going to do that is to pay them more. I don't, you know, no one's giving away golden gooses, you know, or anything there. I do not like conservative approaches towards the employees. What they're doing is trying to eliminate the fact there's a car involved. And they're trying to sit there and say, see, they get a great wage. Yeah, but they got to pay for all the maintenance on the vehicle. You know, driving around in the cities wears down brakes, wears down tires, it wears down. You burn through gas, got to get more oil changes, you got to maintain it and service it. It's pretty pricey. And you're devaluing your car the entire time. They want to act as if that's nothing. And this is why I really am against, I'm starting to really say, let the door hit your cabooses on the way out of town, Uber and Lyft, because I'm sorry. As a company that they start out every freaking press releases, we're concerned about making sure our drivers make a livable wage, but don't ask us to pay them more money, which would give them the livable wage. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward thing at this point. It's not really a mystery what needs to happen here. And yet they, and we did yesterday, we did the math, and don't worry for all the listeners, I'm not about to break out the calculator a second time here, but we did the math and it was a 4 mile, 7 minute drive was basically with this new rate would be $3 more. Now I understand that, some companies are, no one's going to use the service anymore. What are you talking about? It's a lot like when, you know, when Republicans got all upset because Minneapolis put in a minimum wage and they said, what? They, every restaurant's going to close. Nobody wants food. A burger is going to cost $129. No, it doesn't. Cost a few dollars more. And you know what? Fine. Doesn't stop me. Food in this town is pretty darn good. But there's this idea that somehow, some way, and this is where we're at. The only thing they have is now a game of chicken. They're basically saying that the need for Uber and Lyft supersedes paying their drivers. Because once again, as they keep screaming, we're committed to making sure our drivers make a livable wage. They are doing anything but. And once again, it's not only do they discount the car, but they always make this argument, well, they get tips. Well, we've had studies that have shown, no, people don't tip. And that's unfortunate. Now, I do tip, but I'm not trying to play in the Uber Lyft. I have no problem in still tipping if they're making a livable wage. Why do we always have to find some workers to screw over? I don't think that this is a bad deal. And even, by the way, and we even did the math on that ride from, say, Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport to Stillwater, which is a pretty good haul. And I think it was, what, $15, $16 more one way? And you're saying, well, how could you bet? That's a lot of money. Well, it's an, you know, if you come from the airport, you're saying that the flight was that's your deal breaker, that the flight didn't bug you, all the meals you're eating out, the hotel rooms that you got, the Uber Lyft $15 more. Well, I can't go on the trip. What are you talking about, man? I don't think this is nearly the deal breaker you guys think it is. But going to Axios Twin Cities. With their coverage of this, Minneapolis council members, top DFL legislators have announced a compromise to create a statewide pay floor for rideshare drivers, but rideshare companies are not on board with it. A spokesperson for Lyft, which had previously only threatened to leave Minneapolis, said the company would only be forced to end operations throughout the state if the deal came into law. So now they're basically just, what they're trying to do is saying, we're going to threaten you, and they're hoping that that scares people into doing this. What their whole argument is you need to pay people less than a livable wage for our business model to work. And so if you hold us to paying people a livable wage, well, we're going to leave. Let the door hit your ass on the way out. Okay. Just seriously. As a matter of fact, can I grab the door and swing it really hard? See if I can launch them a little bit across the St. Croix River. I have no problem with that. Uber has threatened to leave since Minneapolis's ordinance has increased pay driver passed in March. House Majority Leader Jamie Long told reporters he thinks the companies are bluffing. If he's right, officials may be. Well, my guess is going to be is they're going to leave for a little bit, and then 6 months later, it's like, we're back. And then that's because they're going to realize there's all these other companies. Because once again, if you've not seen, there is like a list of 12 rideshare companies that desperately want to get licensed in Minneapolis to take over after Uber and Lyft leave. And Uber and Lyft, what they're terrified of. Well, the truth is, I don't know if Jamie Long is, they might be bluffing, but they might leave. Because what they don't want to do is set a standard. It's kind of like when Walmart's closed down when a union is voted in. They'll just take the loss on the store, shut down the store, and be done with it, as opposed to recognize the union, because they don't want unions to take foot in the Walmart stores. That could be the same thing here. They might leave, not because they can't make money here, but because they don't want their business model threatened in all these other markets where they say, hey, well, Minneapolis, St. Paul pays a livable wage and you drive up there. Why can't you do it here? I could see that easily. If right, officials may have secured huge raises for more than 8,000 Twin Cities drivers, most of them working class immigrants. For a year and a half, Minneapolis City Council and the state legislature have been debating new rideshare pay standards for intense pressure from the companies. Governor Walz vetoed the past state proposal last year, which I still was a little bothered by. Minneapolis passed its own pay ordinance in March, but agreed to continue working with the legislature on a statewide minimum. Uber and Lyft were not involved in the talks, Long told reporters on Monday. Why should they be? Because, once again, you're just trying to figure out what a livable wage would be for a rideshare driver. It's clear Uber and Lyft do not care and do not want to give a livable wage to their drivers. If you did, they would be the first ones to acknowledge, well, the tip thing is not working out, so yeah, we're okay with the wages. That's not what they want. So I wouldn't. There's no reason to include a business who seems to be dishonest about their motivations from the get-go. Per Monday's deal, Minneapolis leaders agreed to lower their ordinance's pay rate to $1.27 per mile and 49 cents per minute. The city rule, set to take effect on July 1st, had set for $1.40 per mile and 51 cents per minute minimum. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey and business leaders have hoped the legislature would salvage the compromise, keep the rideshare companies in the market. The Lyft, Uber and Lyft reactions to this news dampens those hopes. So long, let the door hit you in the caboose on the way out. The governor also previously urged lawmakers to use a state-backed economic analysis as the basis of the driver pay rate. However, lawmakers' new rate is just outside the study's range for metro area drivers. The study had proposed between 89 cents and $1.29 per mile for metro drivers. In a statement to Axios, Walz's spokesperson did not confirm whether the governor would sign Monday's deal into law, but called it a positive step in the right direction. Dude, I mean, Governor Walz, I really like you. Didn't like Line 3. I did not like Line 3. But overall, I've been very impressed with your term. But this Uber-Lyft thing was the one black eye from last year. You should have signed that bill. And I guess, you know, we're all DFLers here, sir, with all due respect. I'm not a big fan of paying people less than a livable wage. And like I said yesterday, Governor, listen to the show yesterday. In the 4 o'clock hour, I broke down the math of it from about 420 to about 450. I broke down the math of the whole thing. It's not that much of a massive increase. You know, if when I said a 4 mile, 7 minute ride would cost $3 more, a little more than $3 more, do you think that people are going to say, well, I'm to save that $3, I'm going to walk 4 miles? No. Might they take the bus? Fine. You know, or the light rail line works their, you know, magic, sure. The reason I did the example of the airport to Stillwater is because I specifically wanted to go from one destination to another where there wasn't a light rail option. So to say from, you know, because you can jump on the light rail from the airport and go to Minneapolis, jump on one train and go over to St. Paul. So those are a cheap option for you. So going to Stillwater would be a haul. Still was only a little more than $15 more for that route. I did the numbers. I did the math. I get it. People like to have cheap fare. But if to do so, you have to look at a section of our employees and say, you don't deserve a livable wage, I think that's wrong. That's what they do in these Republican states, where you have $2 minimum wages, and they say, well, you make tips. And they say, well, but it's a Monday at lunch rush. No one's here. That's not my problem. You know, we've got this really bad habit of saying we're going to do everything in our power to help the company, but we don't do any, we fail when it comes to helping the worker. And this is not unionizing or anything like this. This is just basically saying, you know what, we want people who are doing this, which is a big deal now, to be able to get paid a livable wage. And I keep hearing a lot of excuses why they shouldn't. And I'm not seeing nearly the hurdle you guys are. This is not going to be a $70 4-mile trip. It's just not. And yeah, I've had my kids take Uber lifts to sporting events, to concerts and stuff from our house. Yeah, it's been a little pricey. And I'm just in Hopkins. But if it's going to be $4 more, all right, if it really is that bad, then why is your kid going to the concert in the first place? Because you clearly can't. If that's your real deal breaker, then should they be going to the concert in the first place? Should they be going to the sporting event where they're going to get a $12 soda, small soda? You know, is that really your deal breaker? The $6 hot dog, the $8 hamburger and fries. Well, $8 is probably cheap. It's probably $12.15 now. Governor Walz, I think the fact that you got Democrats and Republicans working together on this and they've come to some level of agreement, I think that's a good place to be. Uber spokesperson Josh Gold called the deal disappointing, saying the company hopes we can still work with the governor and legislature to the statewide solution that allows rideshare to remain in the state. No, we're going to have rideshare. We're just not going to have Uber and Lyft. You guys seem to keep thinking there's not going to be rideshare. Oh, we're going to have rideshare, just not you. Minneapolis City Council President Elliot Payne told Axios that rideshare platforms should not have the flexibility to pay drivers sub-minimum wages. Monday's deal averts what would have been an awkward scenario in the state DFLers passing legislation to override the DFL majority city. A Minnesota House committee will hear the proposal on Tuesday morning. The council will begin its amendment process next week. There are a few more weeks of the deal making. The legislature must adjourn on May 20th. So you basically have May 20th would be, let's say, it's Tuesday. Of, you know, 2 weeks from today. So, I think it's a good deal. Go listen to yesterday's show. You'll understand the math. Uber and Lyft, I just think that their business model is based on paying people substandard wages and acting like they're noble. And Uber and Lyft, can I just say this? Shut up with the whole, we want our drivers to have a livable wage. No, you don't. No, you don't. And just own it. Hey, we got a super cheap business model that involves basically, you know, less than a living wage for our workers. Sucks to be them. At least just be honest about it, okay? Stop with your whole fake piety. I have no patience for that. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break, come back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on your Tuesday. Shout out to Joe. Thinking about you, my friend. You take care. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. So, final thing today, and I do have to mention this because this is... Okay, I knew things were bad at St. Cloud State. I know that the enrollment was down. I mean, it's something because my son Charlie graduates on Thursday here. By the way, I'm not going to be here Thursday. We got Todd's going to be in, right?
Yeah, Todd's going to be in. Yeah.
Todd's going to be in. I'm going to be over at the University of Minnesota, and then I'm going to Manny's to have a steak. So come on, man.
You're probably
going to
have a better graduation than Trump, though.
Far better. I actually want to see my kid. Anyway, so that's cold. That's cold. Hi, Dad. I'm Eric. I'm right behind you. Anyway, why would you let your son stay in the courtroom for that testimony? Come on, man. Anyway, I know the universities have had a problem since the pandemic because, you know, it just got tough. St. Cloud State seems to have been hit more, but gosh, this is a pretty extensive cut. They plan to cut about 100 programs. Wow. 57 faculty help balance the chronic budget deficit that's also last year's sweeping cuts. Larry Lee, an acting president, announced the proposed cuts to a stunned campus community on Monday afternoon. Administrators are aiming for the university to lean into its 90 strongest degree programs, 35 strongest minor programs. It currently offers 136 degree programs and 85 minor programs. The cuts include criminal justice, gender and women's studies, history, music teaching, sociology, environmental engineering, and hospitality and tourism. You want to know the truth is some of those are not bad ones to cut for this reason, is there's a lot of people I know that go to these universities. Maybe not as much to UMD, but to, say, Mankato State, St. Cloud State, Bemidji State, Moorhead, and with the idea of 2 years there, and then they want to finish up their degree at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities or UMD. And so I think that, you know, some of those programs I can buy. Whether or not that leads to a lower enrollment, I'm not sure. 91% of our students who are enrolled are in the 90 programs that are proposed to remain, said Lee, the vice president of finance administration, who stepped into the top leadership role on Sunday. We're tweaking the model to do better to align with the student interests today. The 57 faculty jobs proposed to be eliminated come from a wide range of studies and equal about 13% of the total number of full-time faculty. The reductions are part of a five-year plan to balance what was projected to be a $24 million budget deficit at the beginning of last year. With last year's cuts, these shrank to about $18 million. This year, the deficit is about $15 million, according to information shared with the faculty. It's undeniable you got a problem. It's just, this is pretty, you don't really have any wiggle room if these cuts don't solve the budget problem. That's the one thing that screams at me. This is kind of it. If all of a sudden you're not stopping the bleeding with this point, now you're going to have to start looking at the programs that you really do have high enrollment in and ask which ones of those do we start cutting. And that's not going to end well for you. Lee said Monday the total of about 175 faculty and staff are anticipated to be eliminated during the five-year plan. This realignment will allow us to create a financially sustainable model moving forward. Last week, Minnesota State System announced outgoing president Robin Wacker, who was slated to serve as president until the end of June, was leaving the post early ahead of the planned cuts. He didn't want to be part of that, but last spring, Wacker announced cuts to 36 faculty jobs and said the university planned to suspend admissions in 70 degrees, certificates and minors to help streamline programming. After those cuts, Wacker said the university would still have about 240 degrees, minors, and certificates. The SCSU leaders have now attributed the chronic budget deficit to steady enrollment decline that wasn't met with a similar reduction in staffing levels, as well as instructional costs that are the highest among the seven Minnesota State universities. Really? Why is that? You wouldn't think that would be, University saw its peak of 18,300 students, both undergraduate and graduate, in 2010. It now has about 10,130. You're basically half your student population, but this ain't going to help. I think what you have to do is you have to start selling the university. And I want St. Cloud State to survive here, but, now you got to get the people to go there for the remaining degrees. Native Roots Radio is up next. Have a good one. We're back on a Wednesday. Till then, see ya.